Today, we're talking about credit card debt. Credit card debt accounts for a whopping $1.1 trillion here in the US. That's trillion with a T. So I'm sure many of our listeners, like most Americans, are using credit, but maybe aren't using it to their advantage.
That's right, Mindy. A lot of folks are misusing credit. So on today's episode, we're going to talk to Ash All About Money, who has a massive TikTok platform teaching folks how to get out of credit card debt and increase their credit scores.
So stick around, because today's episode is meant to serve as a comprehensive foundational crash course on the factors that make up your credit score. We want you to come out of this episode understanding the concrete steps to take so that you are in the habit of practicing good credit hygiene. Hello, 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 and welcome to the Bigger Pockets Money Podcast. My name is Mindy Jensen, and today I'd like to give some credit to my co-host, Scott Trench. On a scale of 1 to 10, Scott, you're an 850.
Thanks, Mindy. I'll give you a high score for that particular intro. All right, we're here to make financial independence less scary, less just for somebody else, to introduce you to every money story and every part of personal finance, because we truly believe financial freedom is attainable for everyone, no matter when or where you're starting or how much debt you have.
Ashley from Ash All About Money, welcome to the Bigger Pockets Money Podcast. I am so excited to talk to you today.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
So Ashley, you started making videos about debt and credit because you were on a journey to get out of debt. First, thank you so very much, because this journey can feel like such a solitary endeavor. And, you know, oh, I'm in debt. I'm embarrassed by it. I'm not going to talk to anybody else about it. And it turns out that, yeah, you're not special. Everybody's in debt. Everybody is trying to get out of debt. So let's talk about your journey to get out of debt.
So I actually got out of, or was getting out of debt twice, two other times, and I was doing it really restrictive. And that worked while I was paying off debt. But then once I got the debt paid off, I went crazy celebrating afterwards. So I found myself in debt for a third time. And then I decided that I needed to change the way that I was managing money. And I started to understand that using credit cards that wasn't supposed to be an extension of our income. That really helped. And I feel like I actually have a handle on it this time, because I'm still spending some, but I'm also, trying to pay down the debt. So I'm being careful of what I'm spending, but budgeting and planning what I'm going to put on my credit cards instead of just going crazy.
So could we go back in time to the first time? How'd you rack up all the debt and how'd you pay it off the first time? Can you tell us a little bit about that story, the ins and outs?
The first time was, I was just young and I wasn't making a lot of money, and I had eventually started a business. So that was a lot of the debt. But then even in the business, I wasn't making a lot of money the first couple of years. And then when I started making good money was when COVID hit. And then I had to take 3 months off and pay expenses. And I also have renters who weren't able to pay because they weren't working. So that was the first time. And then I went to buy a house. So I decided I was going to pay everything down. I did good. I bought the house. I celebrated.
So let's go. Let's unpack this a little bit. How much debt did you rack? So you have renters, but you didn't own a house. Were these roommates basically on your lease that weren't paying you?
No. So I rented out a business space for my business, and I also rented out the back half of it, and they were renting from me. And then I had my primary residence before I bought the second house, which was the one that was during that year of COVID. But like I said, having 3 months off, I think the amount was only $40,000 that time. So it was much more the third time. And the higher my income got, the higher the debt amount got without me managing the money. So that was trouble.
So what was your business at this point in time?
I do permanent hair removal. So a lot of people, it's like skincare type stuff, really, but permanent hair removal, electrolysis is what I do.
Okay. So we have a business, permanent hair removal. It's going pretty well. It just sounds like you're earning a good income, fluctuating, but good income. You rack up a ton of debt, and that's compounded by the fact that the people you're subleasing your office space to stop paying. And then you go through a cycle of getting serious about paying it off. You pay off $40,000 in debt the first time. What was it like paying that off, and how long did that take to pay it off the first time?
I didn't pay it completely off, but I had paid it way down to where, you know, my credit score was happy for the mortgage and things like that. So I was very close to having it paid off. But like I said, I started celebrating. I celebrated the fact that we got the new house and all those things. So,
tell us about the celebration. What were some of the goodies we got for the new house at this point in time?
Well, it was really just me saying I can spend money again. Like I said, I had this mode of either being super restrictive or super spender, and there was no in between. I was really good at being restrictive, but only for that short amount of time, because I would do it within a matter of months, pay down the debt. But after it was over, I was like, okay, I can spend again. And like I said, I just didn't understand that the credit cards shouldn't be used as an extension, or any kind of credit shouldn't be used as an extension of the income. And I think that's where a lot of people get messed up with credit cards, is they use, you know, their whole paycheck and they're also using their credit cards. So that 100% was my problem. Luckily, I've learned the lesson after the third time.
I would love to hear the whole story, because this is fascinating. And I think it's so important to the rest of what we're going to talk about today. How much did we end up racking up for time number two? If time number one was 40,000, what was time number two?
The second time I think was 60,000. And I honestly have no idea where. I can't even remember now what the debt was. But same thing with that. I was going to buy another property, so I needed to pay it back down. So I did that quickly. So, and then again, same thing the third time.
Was this another primary residence?
No, this was. So I had the original house that we were living in. Then we bought another house to live in. That one stayed as a rental, the current house that I had. And then the third property was the business property that I was first renting. And I told the guy, you know, if you ever want to sell this, let me know, and I'd like to buy it.
Awesome. So what was the lifestyle change like, going from racking up 60,000 in debt to paying it off? What was the difference in your day to day?
Spending on everything versus spending on absolutely nothing. Like trying to spend $10 at the grocery store for dinner, or it was a huge change, because usually when I wanted something, I just bought it. And I pretty much had been like that my whole life. I don't know where that comes from, but that's how I am.
So I have frequently equated getting out of debt with losing weight. When you're on a diet or you want to lose weight, you know that you should eat whole vegetables, whole fruits, natural grains, yada, yada, yada. But those are also really boring. Who dreams of an apple? You dream of apple pie, which is a little bit different than an apple. So when you're in debt, you know that you're supposed to spend only on the basics and put all the extra money towards your debt and pay it down. But that's not fun either. That's like eating an apple. Okay, yeah, I'm supposed to, but I don't get any real joy out of it, except Scott. Scott loves apples, but you know, Scott's a big weirdo.
I love apples.
So you know what you're supposed to be doing, but what happens in reality is that, oh, I had a small win, I'm going to go celebrate. Or I had, you know, what's one piece of apple pie? It's my birthday, or I'm on vacation. Like what's, you know, I just bought a house, I need a new couch. It's just one couch. It's just one thing. And like, it starts to snowball. After the break, Ashley will walk us through the biggest and most important three factors that impact your credit score. Interest rates are sky high in 2023, and buying a rental property means you could get stuck with an 8, 9, or 10% mortgage rate. But what about a 2.99% rate with Rent to Retirement? Rent to Retirement has 2.99% seller financing available on turnkey properties. You heard that right. That's a seller financed 2.99% interest rate with an average cash flow of over $900 per month. Plus, they've got options where you can put as little as 5% down with no PMI. As the nation's leading turnkey investment company, Rent to Retirement helps investors build headache-free, high cash flow rental portfolios. And since their properties are fully turnkey, newly built or renovated, leased and managed, anyone can invest, even those who aren't into landlording. So what are you waiting for? This 2.99% rate deal won't last long. To learn more, visit renttoretirement.com. That's renttoretirement.com. Or text REI to 33777. Again, text REI to 33777.
The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting. From finding the best guests, to the maintenance, to organizing the cleaners after every guest day. With Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know a thing about how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a hospitality-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, Vacasa earns homeowners an average of 20% more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa is always thinking of ways to simplify the vacation home owning experience by putting your home to work for you. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home, work with the reliable property manager, and finally have peace of mind, partner with Vacasa at vacasa.com/biggerpockets. That's vacasa.com/biggerpockets.
The easiest way to collect rent? Rent App. Rent App is a seamless, secure, free payment tool for small rental property owners like you and me. Built by a team of fintech veterans behind Square and Cash App, Rent App uses ACH bank transfers to deposit rent directly into your account. Landlords love Rent App for its unbeatable convenience. Isn't it time you made rent collection easier? Rent App, the free and easy way to collect rent. Learn more at rent.app/landlord. That's rent.app/landlord.
Welcome back to the Bigger Pockets Money Podcast. We're talking to Ashley from Ash All About Money about how to tackle your credit score by changing your credit habits.
You said you were in debt the first time $40,000, the second time $60,000. I don't know if you didn't say or if I didn't catch how much debt the third time.
The third time, it was around $112,000. Part of that was another business investment that I knew that we were going to have to put money towards. So I included that in that number. So the debt itself actually wasn't quite that high, but it was close.
What was the business investment?
A dispensary. So a lot of cash has to go into that.
How long did it take you to pay off the $40,000 the first time?
Maybe 5 or 6 months.
And then the $60,000 the second time?
Probably about the same.
And then how about this last one?
And the last one, it's been 9 months. So it started, let's say, at the 112. It's down to about 60, so I'm hoping to have that paid off by the end of the year.
Fantastic. That's awesome.
It's not really awesome.
Well, it's an awesome amount of progress that you made in 9 months. You paid off 60 grand in debt.
Right. It is great progress. I'm happy that I learned the lesson. Like you said, it is very similar to weight loss, but you can have dessert sometimes. You just can't have it all the time. And it's the same with spending. And I'm really happy that I was able to find a balance now between I'm still spending, but I'm also still paying off my debt. So finding the balance was nice, rather than having the two super spender and super restrictive, because that didn't work for me.
You know, I said you're not alone in your debt journey. You're not alone in this as well. It's not like you're the only person who ever got out of debt and then fell back into it. That's a really common cycle.
And like the weight loss, it takes lifestyle changes that you have to maintain over a period of time to get where you want to be and stay where you want to be instead of the up down roller coaster. So the lifestyle changes are huge. And I think once I realized that as well, that was a big part of, okay, you know, let's get this debt paid off and then work towards the financial independence part of things. So
you used the word financial independence. Was that a motivating factor at any point in this debt cycle, and when did it become a motivating factor? When did it become a goal?
So that's always been my motivating factor. And I just couldn't understand, why do I keep ending up in these messes of debt? So that was what really made me take a hard look. And luckily, I have the real estate where my net worth is still positive. So I always felt comfortable. And that's another thing, I could just sell one of my other properties to get out of this debt. But that would be taking the easy way, which would open me back up to the celebration and the spending. And I'm not learning any lessons if I do it that way, which I've done that with personal loans too. You know, okay, I'm going to take out this personal loan, pay off my credit cards. Yay, my cards are paid off. I'm going to go spend some money. I don't want to take the easy way anymore. I want to do it. I want to do it the right way. And so that's what we're doing. But yes, the overall goal is financial independence.
Love it. So what's going to be different this time in terms of your approach to knocking out the remaining $60,000 in debt and what you're going to do afterwards?
Well, like I said, I'm just really continuing to spend, but very carefully. And I now budget the things that I'm going to spend on my credit cards instead of just swiping them whenever I want to. So I basically only use my credit cards, and then whatever money I have in my bank account, I don't touch that. And then I pay that towards the credit cards plus the extra to get the balances down. So I'm being responsible with the credit cards, which I've always pretty much used the cards, but Like I said, I'm planning more now what I'm going to put on them. So if I want to buy something, a larger purchase, then I will plan for that. And I know which credit card is going on and how much I'm going to have to pay back or pay more extra to the following month by doing that.
Love it. And I think that your content that you do on TikTok, you realize that this credit card situation was something that confused a lot of people. What were some of the thing, like, this is not just you. This is a lot of people that are confused by this. Can you tell us what some gaps are in people's knowledge around this stuff?
When I started posting, I knew my cards were maxed out and I knew that I knew how to improve my credit score while I was paying those cards down. So I started posting the credit card balance, the amount I was going to pay, the due date, the statement date, and things like that. And then there were just a lot of questions specifically around the statement date because people didn't understand that at all. And then they didn't understand how to monitor their credit or where to check it or how often they can check it. Does it ding them if they check it? There were just so many questions around credit cards and credit scores. And I'm like, hey, I know this information. And that was another reason that I kind of started to post it, was because when I got out of debt that first time, or, you know, younger, trying to look up information about credit cards, I could never find the information that I wanted as far as increasing my credit score and what would be best. Like, if I do this, then this is probably going to happen with my score. And I was never able to find that. So I knew how to do those things. So I'm like, I'm going to show other people because I know this will help people.
Okay, let's talk about credit scores and credit cards. Can you break down for us what goes into a credit score?
So the credit score is 5 different factors: the payment history, credit utilization, credit age, credit mix, new credit.
And what do each of those mean? Let's talk about payment history.
So payment history makes up 35% of our credit score, and that's the amount of on-time payments we have. So if we miss any payments, that's where those are going to show. And it's super important to always make on-time payments. I've also made that mistake before too.
When I was getting my very first mortgage, they asked me about one late payment that I got, like, I don't know, it was like 3 or 4 years beforehand. I was like, I'm supposed to remember that? I don't even remember what I had for breakfast.
Yep. I got in a car accident and they said, so the car accident was 2016. I think I made 3 late payments, but one of them was on a mortgage. And when I went to get the mortgage in 2020, they said, what was that late payment from 2016? And, you know, it's easy to explain. I was in a car accident and I would, you know, didn't have the money and that's all that was, but they don't like it.
So how are you teaching people to use their payment history to their advantage?
Well, if they've been making on-time payments, they obviously want to continue to make on-time payments. But if they have late payments on their report, they just need to continue to now make those on-time payments, because eventually over time, those late payments have less of an impact and their scores will eventually recover from that and they'll eventually fall off of their credit too.
What counts as an on-time payment? Like, you know, like the credit card, sometimes you can pay the minimum, you can pay more than the amount due. What are the rules around how much I have to pay to get full marks here?
To make the on-time payment, you have to make the minimum payment by the due date. But a lot of people don't know too, if you miss the due date, say that your payment was due on the 1st and you forgot about it until the 3rd or the 4th, and you realize, oh shoot, I didn't make that payment. You usually have 30 days with the creditors before it's reported to the credit bureau as being late. Now, in my head, I've been in these bad financial situations before. Instead of saying 30, I say 28 days, just to give myself that extra 2-day buffer. If I do have to make a late payment, or if I plan to make something late, at least 28 days after the payment was due, you need to make the payment. But it's technically 30 days for most creditors.
So and another part of it that confuses some people is when I look at my credit card statement and my credit card balance, those are different numbers. Can you walk us through the difference between those two items and why that might confuse people and which one to pay?
Right. So we have a statement balance, we have a current balance, and then we have the minimum amount due. So we always have to at least make the minimum amount due if we don't want the late fees or that late payment reported on our credit report. But then the statement balance is the balance from the end of the last billing cycle. So whenever the last statement closed, that balance is what our statement balance is, and we have to pay that if we don't want to be charged any interest on our credit cards. And then the current balance is the statement balance plus or minus any charges that we've made in the current billing cycle.
Yeah, it's confusing. It's a language you got to learn if you want to succeed in this thing.
Right. And those details are the things that people don't always understand. The you know, they don't, a lot of people don't even realize that there's two different balances because they just look at the current balance. They don't really look at their statement too much to see that there's a statement balance. And if they do see it, they may not know what it means. So
let's walk through the next factor in your credit score, which is credit utilization. Can you define credit utilization and tell us what it is?
Credit utilization is the amount of the available credit that we are using. And that makes up 30% of our credit scores. And the reason that I talk about utilization so much is because we have a lot of control over the utilization on our credit cards. So if we're looking to improve our credit score, that's one of the easiest places for us to start because it's the simplest for us to fix. You know, you can't really get rid of late payments. You can't always make your credit age longer, but you can pay down your credit cards to have a lower utilization rating to improve your credit score.
So Ashley, you have a lot of information out there about credit utilization. Let's start off with what percentage do you recommend to stay under when you're trying to either keep your good credit score or raise your credit score?
So most of the time you'll hear stay at 30% or under, which if you're at 10 to 29% utilization, that's considered good as far as the ratings on utilization go. But if you're at 0 to 9%, that's considered excellent. So usually for like if you're going to get a mortgage or something, under 30% is going to be acceptable to the lenders, which I think is where that comes from. But if you want to have the best credit score, you want your utilization to be as low as you can get it, but ideally in that 0 to 9% range.
Then why do they give us such high credit scores or credit limits if they don't want us to use it?
They should give us higher ones.
That's so frustrating. Okay, you have a credit utilization chart that someone can use on their journey of paying off credit card debt. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Yeah, so I made the credit utilization chart because, like I said, when I was trying to figure out how to improve my credit score, I was reading a lot on credit utilization, but it also breaks down the balances, especially if you have maxed out credit cards. It's a lot easier to break the balances down into smaller goal balances along the way of paying off the card completely because you see the progress you're making. You can still celebrate those small wins along the way while your balance is going down. So it kind of just gives you like hurdles as you're going, you know, okay, I got the first one down. Now I'm going to the next stage of the utilization. But it does help you with progress, I think, just to see you had a goal, you made the goal. Now you move on to the next goal, even though the overall goal is not done yet, but you're still making progress along the way.
That sounds a lot like the debt snowball, the Dave Ramsey method of like paying your smallest one and then your next one. Are you debt snowball or debt avalanche?
I actually don't do either. I pay all of my cards down at the same time. I have done the snowball before, and the problem that I found with snowball was it was really easy for me to pay off the lower cards, but I was always stuck with that high balance on the highest card at the end, and that was the hardest for me to get down. So I would rather almost start with the highest one first, but I kind of pay them all down. I probably do a combination of snowball because the cards that have lower limits are obviously easier to pay down the utilization on those. So a lot of times if I have a couple $100s and that will change the utilization, I'll put it towards the lowest card, but still continue to make sure that those higher card balances are coming down at the same time.
Yeah. At the end of the day, it comes down to you will eventually have to pay off that large amount. I prefer the avalanche because mathematically it's a better choice, but I understand the snowball because you get those small wins and that can help you, you know, propel you forward. Oh, I've got $30,000 on my credit card and I paid down $100. Yay. It's so easy to get discouraged.
It works well for some people. And I always say that people should do whatever method they feel like works best for them. And whichever method they can stick to is the method that is best for them. So I would stick to the snowball for a period of time. I've never tried the avalanche just because I thought snowball was easier, but I ultimately didn't stick to that either because those larger cards never got paid off. But people really have to find what works best for them and do what works best for them in their situation because what motivates me may not motivate other people. And some people, they like to kind of argue in my comments that it doesn't matter what our credit score is. Well, it does if that's what motivates you, you know, so it just depends on what you're motivated by. And some people aren't motivated by a credit score and that's totally fine. So they can do it a different way that they prefer. But I know a lot of people that are motivated by the credit score.
So let's talk about that for a second here. There's some games we can play here around debt, right? And how we pay off things. So there's the debt avalanche, debt snowball, but there's also, if I want to boost my credit score, at least temporarily, I can pay down something that's close to my credit limit, for example, instead of paying down my car loan, for example. Can you explain, maybe give us a framework on thinking about that and maybe help us understand also, is there, there's another layer, I think, that you've talked about, how there's a difference between credit due date and the statement date, and knowing that difference and playing games there can help you with your credit utilization, I believe.
So our statement dates are the dates that our cards report to the credit bureau. So we always want to keep our credit card balances low on those dates. So the statement date is usually 3 to 5-ish days after the due date. So what I try to do is make the payment on the due date, and then I won't make any more spend any more on the credit cards until after the statement closes. That way it reports at that lower balance, whatever I had paid a couple of days previous. And then other certain things show utilization, like our credit cards and lines of credit will show utilization, but our mortgages, our car loans, personal loans, those don't show utilization. So you're right there. If you're wanting to improve your credit score, you really should focus on credit cards or revolving accounts that are showing utilization first.
Well, I love it. These are some awesome tips on how to handle these first two items.
Okay, so you just said that payment history is 35% of your score and credit utilization is 30%. So fully 65% of your score is absolutely under your control. You control if you make your payments on time. And look, like I said, I have had a late payment in my past. It's so easy to just not pay it on time. But if you've got the funds in your account, and you really should not be spending more, but that's a different story. If you've got the funds in your account and you know you're bad at making payments on time, automate it. Right there, 35% of your score is under your control because you're not leaving it to chance. Your bank can set this up. And back when I had my late payment, this is before online banking, barely before the internet. So it was a lot, I don't want to say harder, because how hard is it to write a check and mail it in? It's not that difficult. Come on, I'm an adult. But there's so many other things going on in your life that it's easy to forget. So your credit utilization, the amount of credit that you have available to you, don't charge up your cards all the way. Two factors makes up more than half, almost two thirds of your credit score. The other ones.
Right. And those are both the high impact factors to our scores. And then another one is medium. And then we have two low impact. But if anything to focus on, it's definitely payment history and credit utilization, 100%.
All right, we're going on a quick break. When we're back, Ashley from Ash All About Money will tell us how to monitor and keep track of your credit while you're paying back large sums of credit card debt.
Remember when you had to pay to get a lead's phone number? It was like the dark ages, until Deal Machine made skip tracing a thing of the past. Now, with your Deal Machine plan, you'll get unlimited access to phone numbers and contact information for no extra cost. That's right. Get high quality, reliable information trusted by leading financial institutions, all fully compliant with the federal Do Not Call list. Explore over 150 data points, including age, gender, marital status, occupation, and a ton more. Trust me, this is the data you need for off-market deals. With new filters, people flags, and color-coded phone numbers, lead management just got a ton easier. Ready to step up your investing game? Sign up for a Deal Machine plan today and gain immediate access to this unlimited treasure trove of contact information and phone numbers. Just head to dealmachine.com/BP. Transform your lead generation and deal-making strategies with Deal Machine. Sign up today and start exploring the unlimited possibilities at dealmachine.com/BP.
Listen up, business owners. Here's some quick math. Fewer costs equals more profit. The problem? You're spending more than ever on operations, materials, deliveries, software, and more. So why not reduce your costs and headaches with NetSuite by Oracle? NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. NetSuite lives in the cloud, which means you can reduce IT costs with no hardware required. Cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because now you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. It makes sense that over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Don't let rising costs sink your business's growth. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks, head to netsuite.com/BP money. That's netsuite.com/BP money. netsuite.com/BP money.
This show is sponsored by Airbnb. Did you know that a long time ago, before I ever started my real estate business, I turned one of my first primary residences into an Airbnb? And that's the extra income that I needed from Airbnb that gave me the confidence to go out and work for myself and eventually quit my 9-to-5 job. And now I have dozens of Airbnbs all over the country. I've even partnered up with the old David Green on a recent property in Scottsdale to take our portfolio to the next level. And of course, we host it on Airbnb. But you don't need to be a full-time real estate investor to start on Airbnb. As a matter of fact, I was self-managing 10 properties while working my 9-to-5 job, so I know anybody can do it. Think about it this way. You're looking for extra income and going on a vacation. Wouldn't it be great to rent out your space and let your property pay for itself while you're gone? I did this one time. I pitched my wife and my roommate, because we were house hacking, on the idea of renting out our home, and it paid for all of our expenses on a trip to Mexico City. So go and give it a try. It might just change your life, just like it did mine. And I really do mean that. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Pretty good episode, right? While you were listening, you could have been getting paid rent with RentApp. Landlords love RentApp because it makes rent collection a breeze. RentApp uses ACH bank transfers to deposit funds directly into your account. Setup is straightforward for renters. Landlords don't need to download anything. Both have peace of mind with a digital transaction history. Isn't it time you made landlording a little easier? RentApp, the best way to pay or collect rent. Learn more at rent.app/landlord. That's rent.app/landlord. Deciding how to invest your capital can be extremely challenging, especially when the market is constantly changing. That's why it's never been more important to partner with a company that has a great track record. The BAM Capital executive team has successfully navigated through the Great Recession, COVID-19, and the current interest rate environment while delivering maximized returns to their partners. BAM Capital is a trusted multifamily syndicator with over $1.3 billion in transactions, delivering a historical average of over 35% IRR with an average hold period of 3.5 years. BAM Capital has consistently paid preferred return distributions for over 50 consecutive months, has not lost limited partners' capital, and has not called capital past the subscription amount. BAM Capital's disciplined investment strategy is targeting undermanaged institutional quality trophy assets throughout the U.S. heartland for accredited investors who are looking for generational wealth building or monthly income opportunities. Their offerings target cash flow stability, capital preservation, long-term appreciation, and accelerated tax benefits. Join BAM Capital's over 1,200 investors across 44 states and get started today at BAMCapital.com. Again, that's BAMCapital.com. Welcome back to the show.
Let's move on to the third factor here, which is your credit length. Can you explain what this is and how that impacts your score?
The credit length is the age of the time that we've had our credit accounts. So if we have two accounts, one that's 10 years old and one that we opened yesterday, the average of those times would be 5 years. So if you have multiple accounts, it's just going to average out, and you don't want to open too many new accounts at one time because it will hurt that credit age.
Awesome. So we should be wary of the travel hacking tips that we gave in a recent interview here. And if we open too many credit cards and don't have enough older accounts, that can impact our credit score. How impactful is this, and any tricks when I'm thinking about the next line of credit?
The credit age is 15% of our credit score, and you can make the credit age longer if you become an authorized user on someone else's account. So if you have a parent, a friend, anyone that has good credit and they are responsible with their credit, maybe they have a card that they've had for 15 or 20 years, you can be added as an authorized user on their account, and it will make your credit age look longer. Now, this doesn't always work because some accounts, I believe American Express is like this. If you get added as an authorized user on an American Express card, it won't transfer over the amount of time that that person had that card. It'll start out as a new card to you. I had that happen once.
Ooh, that's a good tip. So it sounds like I shouldn't be closing out my credit cards. I should just keep them forever. And I do actually have one that I opened like 35 years ago that I have kept open because I've had it for so long. And every once in a blue moon, I'll charge something on it. Is there any case that it makes sense to close out a card?
Suggest people don't, just because of the credit age factor. I mean, if you really dislike a card, you can. But a lot of reasons that people want to close a card is because maybe it has an annual fee or something like that, and they feel like they're not getting the full benefits out of what the fee is. So if they call their credit card company and say, can I downgrade this card to a lower tier card that doesn't have an annual fee? That's kind of a way to get around it. If they did want to close that card just because of the fee, they could just downgrade to a lower tier card that doesn't have a fee.
That is a great tip. I've never heard that tip before. I love that.
Well, let's move on to the next category here, which is new credit. What is that and how does that factor into your score? And why is it different than credit length history?
So new credit is the amount of new accounts that we've opened within a certain period of time, 6 to 12 months or so. It makes up 10% of our credit score. And you don't want to open too many new accounts at one time because creditors don't like to see you open a lot of new credit accounts at once because they see that you could possibly be a risk. Like, why were you opening all those accounts a couple months ago? So if you just open one or two, if you need to wait 6 months or so, do more, then it's better to do it like that than opening five at once.
What is a tactical approach to opening up new credit if I'm a beginner here? And how do I go about this in a way that doesn't spook the credit companies and hurt my score too much? Because I do have to open some new stuff in order to begin building credit history.
So if you're new to credit, I would open one or two accounts to start with, start using those cards or accounts responsibly. And then after a couple months, when you see your credit score start to increase, you have a little bit of credit history there, then go in and apply for another one after that. But don't do 10 in a day or 10 in a month, do one or two, wait 3 to 6 months, do a couple more, and then just continue adding from there.
Okay, let's talk about secured cards. If somebody has really bad credit, and just cannot get a traditional credit card, they can only get a secured card. How long should they wait before trying, once they have the secured card, before trying to get a more traditional credit card?
It's kind of the same as a new credit user, where if they have bad credit, they get the secured card. And those, they don't always get approved for those either. But once they get that card, if they get it, then they would be responsible with that credit. And then their credit score will start to increase. So same thing, I would probably wait a couple months before applying for another card. And one card that is, it's not really a good card, but Credit One Bank has a card that is helpful for rebuilding. And all credit cards can be helpful for rebuilding, but this one specifically because it does approve lower credit scores. So if people starting with those lower credit scores, some people have not been approved for secured card, but they were able to get that Credit One card. Like I said, it's not the best card, but it does the job of, helping to at least get you access to credit that you can be responsible with.
Can you be turned down for a secured card?
Yeah, I think so. It depends on, I guess, income and other things too. But I've heard of people not being able to get secured cards.
The last factor is credit mix. What does this mean?
Credit mix is the different type of credit accounts that we have. So like I said earlier, credit cards are different than a car loan or a mortgage. So you want to have multiple different types of credit accounts. The banks like to see that because they want to see that you're responsible with more than one kind of credit card. It's a lot easier to be responsible with a mortgage than it is to be responsible with a credit card, because the mortgage, you just make the payment and you can't spend back on it. So they want to see you being responsible with an available credit limit on maybe a credit card or a line of credit.
So what is the difference between revolving credit and a line of credit?
Revolving credit, there's revolving credit and then there's installment loans. So the revolving credit is the line of credit, like a home equity line of credit, and then our credit cards. And then installment loans are things like car loans, personal loans, mortgages. And with the revolving accounts, you can continuously borrow back from them. Whereas the mortgages and the car loans, you get the loan one time and you pay off the loan. You're not able to borrow back from that loan. So that's the difference between the two.
Should we have both with regards to our credit score?
Yeah, it shows that good credit mix. So, which is what banks want to see. The more credit accounts you have, I think with the ratings for the credit mix, they want you to have many accounts. I think even up to 10 is still in the needs work or not great category. So they want you to have a lot of different types of credit accounts, or just a lot of accounts, period. If you look in Credit Karma, this category says total accounts. So the more accounts you have, the better it looks on your credit score.
That was a great breakdown of the areas here that impact credit and a lot of great tips. How does someone keep track of all of their stuff related to their credit score? How do I check my credit score and how do I keep track of it?
So I really like to use Credit Karma. And I know some people will say don't use Credit Karma because Credit Karma report or shows us a Vantage score, whereas most lenders are pulling the FICO scores. But Credit Karma shows our credit factors amazing. Anything you want to know, if you go into Credit Karma and click on one of those credit factors, you can see exactly what's going on pretty much all the time with your credit. So for me, that's the best place to look as far as monitoring utilization and things like that. I've seen some of the other FICO scoring, you know, places that you can check, and they don't show quite as much information as Credit Karma. But then there's also MyFICO that you can, it's like $40 a month to get all three bureaus. I think that's a good place too, but I still prefer personally Credit Karma for me. And it doesn't seem like any of the scores are 100% accurate because I've had the Vantage score not be accurate, but I've also had FICO scores not be accurate, and including the different FICO scores from like MyFICO. So I'm not sure that there's one that's going to be 100% accurate anyway. But as far as factors go, Credit Karma is the place to go for that.
All right, one more question here. You know, for a Dave Ramsey follower, for example, Dave Ramsey has said, I believe I'm quoting him accurately, that credit scores are BS. You don't need them, and you should strive to be completely debt free. And you know, after a certain point, if you live debt free, you won't even have a credit score for that. What would you say to somebody with the kind of that mentality? An aversion to debt and thinking it through the credit system here?
You know, I hear it all the time. And Dave Ramsey does say credit score is an I love debt score. So, and his followers, they definitely are in the comments. But I mean, if that works for them, that's fine. And like I said, everybody has their own way. If you don't feel like you need a credit score and you can do it without one, I'm sure there's a way to do it. I've never tried it. I don't think I would suggest it just because it seems a lot easier to just have the credit score and be responsible with credit. And, you know, if you want to get a mortgage, you go to the bank and you get a mortgage, how we typically are used to going to the bank to getting a mortgage.
I will say that as a real estate agent, I have never worked with somebody trying to get a mortgage with a zero credit score. Having a zero credit score is much better than having a like 400 credit score. But it is so much easier to get a mortgage. And I hate this phrase, but when you're playing the game with the same pieces that everybody else is playing. So I respectfully disagree with Dave and his philosophy of having a zero credit score. It's not to say you can't do it. You're just adding a lot of pressure on top of yourself. And strictly from a mortgage perspective, if I am listing a house and somebody has a mortgage pre-approval from a regular mortgage company that I've heard of, and somebody else has this, like, I have a zero credit score, crazy mortgage, I know that the zero credit score is going to be harder to get a mortgage. And I'm going to encourage my seller to go with the more traditional route. And it's not an I love debt score. I have an awesome credit score and I don't like debt at all. It's just, I'm playing the game under the rules that have already been established. One last question that I have for you, Ashley. You are entitled to one copy of your credit report from each of the three credit reporting bureaus every year. Do you recommend pulling all three at once or one every 4 months to more monitor it?
It depends on what's going on with your credit. If you see that there's an error somewhere on one of those credit reporting apps, then in that case, I would pull all three just to make sure that all three of them don't have the same error. But actually on annualcreditreport.com, when you check your credit reports now, ever since COVID, they started doing it where you can actually pull them weekly. So that's really nice. You don't have to wait the whole year anymore. And the last time, I haven't checked it recently, but the last time, it was probably a month or so ago when I checked, you could actually pull it every single week if you needed to. So that was, that's really helpful, especially if you're going to, you know, get a mortgage or something like that. And you want to double check and make sure that everything on your credit report, not just your score, is accurate.
I did not know that. That's awesome. That's awesome. Okay. Ashley, this has been so much fun and so eye-opening. Thank you so much for your time today. Where can people find you online?
Ash All About Money on TikTok and on Instagram.
Awesome. And we will, of course, include links to both of those in our show notes. Ashley, Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. This was super fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, Scott, that was Ash All About Money. And that was very eye-opening. I learned several things today, including downgrading to a lower card with no fee will keep your credit length of history without changing, with no longer charging you the annual fee, which I think is quite fascinating because I have had several cards that I have canceled due to the high fee instead of just asking for a downgrade. So thank you, Ash, for that great tip.
I learned, Mindy, that a lot of folks, I think, are probably in Ashley's situation and penduluming back and forth between accumulating debt and paying it off, accumulating debt and paying it off. And that's a totally normal experience. And I thought it was a wonderful that she shared that with us, because I think that can be hard for a lot of people to talk about, that they continue to get into and out of debt, even after going through what is surely a months or years of grind to pay off the first batch of debt. So just know that you're not alone if that's going on, and that, you know, yes, you need to buckle up and get this next pile of debt paid off to move on to a financial independence, but there's nothing to be ashamed of, only a system to build that can propel you indefinitely towards your financial goals.
Yes. And one mistake is not going to derail your entire financial future. So you hit a snag in the road, pick yourself up, dust off your knees, and keep moving forward. I really like that she shared her experiences with our listeners, because sometimes it can be really difficult to relate to somebody when they don't have any problems. All right, Scott, should we get out of here?
Let's do it.
That wraps up this episode of the Bigger Pockets Money Podcast. He, of course, is the Scott Trench, and I am Mindy Jensen saying goodbye, Firefly.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please give us a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple. And if you're looking for even more money content, feel free to visit our YouTube channel at youtube.com/biggerpocketsmoney.
Bigger Pockets Money was created by Mindy Jensen and Scott Trench, produced by Kaylin Bennett, editing by Exodus Media, copywriting by Nate Weintraub. Lastly, a big thank you to the Bigger Pockets team for making this show possible.
The market is changing. Finding your way can be tricky. Rates shift, headlines whirl, but your goal hasn't changed. You want financial freedom. And the best investors know it's not about timing the market. It's about time in the market. If you're ready to get into the real estate investing game or take your game to the next level, finding an investor-friendly agent is your next step. With BiggerPockets Agent Finder, you can find the right agent in minutes. Just head to biggerpockets.com/deals. Enter a few details about what and where you want to buy, and boom, instantly match with an investor-friendly agent who fits the bill. These local market experts can help you navigate the neighborhoods, analyze the numbers, and take action with confidence once and for all. This free resource is only available at biggerpockets.com/deals. Get an agent, get the deal, and get closer to financial freedom at biggerpockets.com/deals. That's biggerpockets.com/deals to find your investor-friendly agent today.
The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only.
Past performance is not indicative of future results, and all host and participant opinions are their own.
Investment in any asset, real estate included, involves risk. Use your best judgment and consult with qualified advisors before investing. Only risk capital you can afford to lose.
Bigger Pockets LLC disclaims all liability for direct, indirect, consequential, or other damages arising from reliance upon information presented in this podcast.